Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solver.
Just a reminder that this podcast is intended to be purely educational and is not meant as medical advice. Any patient information has been modified to protect the patient's identity. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of our employers.
Enjoy the show!
Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solvers. It's Kaylin.
And it's Charmin here. We're so excited. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of WDX, Women in Diagnosis Series. What episode is this, Kaylin?
It is episode 5 of 4.
Of the mini-series. We're great at math, everyone. Don't worry about us.
Right. It's no longer a mini-series. It's a maxi-series.
Wow. Kaylin. Queen of dad jokes and puns.
I'm here all night, guys.
On that note, we are very excited for this episode and for y'all to hear it. We have the amazing co-founders of Introspective Spaces, an organization that is building reflective community for women in healthcare.
We are really excited to focus on these women and their organization because they really focus and create a space for introspection and reflection as the root for self-awareness and authenticity. And, you know, often I think creating the space and time for introspection and reflection is often an afterthought in healthcare and in our field. And it's often viewed as a luxury, but it should really be a requirement and such a critical part of who we are and what we do. So I'm just really glad that they're highlighting this and making space for and supporting other women to do it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And this is a topic that we are both very passionate about and care deeply. And so it's very a cool conversation. And I'm so grateful for the work that they do.
And I have a very special place in my heart for Anu, one of the co-founders, because I met her in medical school just by chance. I happened to overlap with her one day on this international rotation. So we had lunch as a group and then paths crossed again many, many years later when we found out this year that we ended up working in the same hospital. So it's really cool to have met her when we were in medical school and to see all the amazing things that she has done so far, including founding an organization with her co-founder, Laura. So it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Anu Gorakanti. Dr. Gorakanti is a public health advocate and pediatric hospitalist at a county hospital in Los Angeles, California, who is passionate about health equity and racial justice. She completed undergraduate and medical school at St. Louis University and completed her residency at Stanford University. She is passionate about social justice and the role that reflection and contemplation play as building blocks for revolution, as inspired by many theologians, spiritual leaders, and activists before her. She strongly believes that understanding who you are, what you value, and where your values come from can lead to a meaningful and authentic life. In her perspective, social change should always honor and incorporate both individual and systems-based approach.
And it's my absolute pleasure to introduce Laura Halford, RN MSN, is an oncology certified nurse and public health nurse committed to working to reduce nursing burnout and moral distress and the assembly of responsibility and accountability in healthcare. Liberation theology led her to train as master's prepared nurse at University of San Francisco. She works as a community health nurse in Sacramento, California. She has a background as a campus minister and was lay community pastor of a Christian interfaith church. And she enjoys nothing more than accompanying people on their healing, reflective, and spiritual paths. Like many mystics before her, she believes that contemplation and action cannot be separated and finds herself naturally helping others build reflective, imaginative, and spiritual practices to ground their action and work in the world. One of the things that they actually both reflect on and told us about how they got close was when they became each other's accountability partner as they were going through all these different experiences in their training. And I really love the idea of having an accountability partner. So a few days after we recorded, I texted you and decided that, you know, okay, guess what? Now you're also my accountability partner.
Great. That's great. We made it official.
I know, exactly. We finally defined it because I was reflecting and I'm like, wow,
Kaylin has been my accountability partner for so long now. And one thing we've been working on is exercising more. And I'm happy to report that we just came off of a Peloton ride right before we recorded this intro. So it's working great for us. I highly encourage everyone to find their accountability partner.
That's right. Get yourself an accountability partner and a Cody Rigsby to get you through the day.
Cody Rigsby. What a great
job. All right. Well, I hope that everyone enjoys the episode. So you were telling us about how you and Laura met.
Yeah, so my husband and I met when we were freshmen in college, and Laura and my husband went to high school together. So I feel like we met really early on, probably freshman or sophomore year of college, like just when I would visit my husband or we're in California. I don't even remember now. It's been so many years.
There was a girl that he was agonizing over buying the perfect gift for. And that was my first introduction to a new.
Here we are.
And we were telling a new before you logged in that Charmaine and I were both in Nilesh's med school class.
It's small world.
So how did things evolve? Like how did, I guess, outside of Nilesh, I guess enough talk about Nilesh. How did your relationship evolve? How did you...
On and upwards, yeah.
Exactly. I feel like, Laura, you're like the exact great friend that I hope every guy has. I feel like that's what I'm taking away from so far in this conversation. It's just, dear man, find yourself a good friend like Laura who can help you buy a mug. It's great.
Exactly. That's like the number one takeaway from this podcast now. Just find that friend and keep them.
For sure.
But yeah, we were friends for so many years, like before then and well before our actual clinical careers began. And I think the root of our friendship for a long time was our spiritual practices. Like I identify as like Hindu Buddhist and practice a lot of Eastern faith traditions. And Laura identifies as contemplative Christian. And so even though we didn't come from the same background, like we still, our spirituality was really important to us. And so that was one of the things that we talked about for many years before joining healthcare. And then just as we both started our healthcare journeys, started talking even more, like, and sharing experiences and serving as accountability partners. And when I graduated in the pandemic and then started my first attending job, I was like witnessing all this like really tragic stuff that happens to kids in like the NICU and in these places. And I was, all this had happened in residency and there wasn't time or space to process it. And then now as an attending, I was like, I don't know if I can stay in medicine. Like if I don't have a way to talk about this and grieve what I'm witnessing or to like honor these families. And that's a lot of what our early conversations were just me calling Laura on my drive home from San Francisco and just saying like, yeah, this patient died. I just had to keep rounding. I had to keep working that day and I never got a chance to talk about it with anybody, but I want to share what I learned about this family and to like actually feel like I can honor what I witnessed.
I kind of forgot that we started as accountability partners. Thank you for reminding me of that. I think we wanted to hold each other to being who we wanted to be in such a chaotic environment. We both are deeply rooted in our spirituality and our values. And so being thrown into, for me, you know, as a new grad nurse and for a new residency, just that disorientation and how can we hold on to who we are during that time. And that evolved, those conversations evolved. And I think mainly we had no intention of doing any kind of, you know, social venture that we're doing now. It was simply a space to witness each other. And I had a therapist, I had family, I had friends, I had this, all these supports in my life, and I still felt very isolated in my work. And so it was really profound to have somebody who could understand my experience without being there and bear witness to the distress that I was coping with and helping me label that and find words for that. So that's how it started, was just witnessing each other through those really rocky first couple of years of our careers. And then we found out how powerful that was for us. We're like, what if we did this with more people? Like, what if we get a group together? What if we do a retreat? And so we did our first virtual retreat during COVID online almost, 3 years ago this month, with just people within our own networks. And there was about 30 women across disciplines. PT to chaplain to nurse, etc. And yeah, we just wanted to build a space that crossed hierarchy, medical hierarchy, that disrupted these norms that we normally follow in a clinical environment, where we could bring our authentic selves and where we could turn to practices that had helped us walk out of our chaos into healing and bring those practice to others. Yeah, I think having accountability with others too, to walk that path.
Yeah, that is such a beautiful summary. Thank you so much for walking us through that. And oh my God, there's so many questions that I have for you and so many things I would love to reflect with you about. And one thing that just came to my mind as you all were commenting about like spirituality, I wonder, like, how do you all incorporate that and into a larger discussion? I feel like people come from different backgrounds and different meaning of like spirituality and religion comes within its own biases. So how do you all like incorporate and have a conversation about that?
Yeah, happy. I mean, I think probably the easiest way we begin is just by modeling our own interfaith and interdisciplinary friendship and saying that we may believe different things. And what we are doing is kind of what we had shared, is like witnessing and acknowledging each other. And we also kind of bring in a broad definition of like spirituality and contemplative practice, of people connecting with themselves and something bigger than themselves. And people can define that by an organized religion. And I feel like there's actually a lot of people in healthcare who do, but who may not feel comfortable talking about it out loud or feel nervous about being judged. And there's also a lot of people for whom that is a very triggering or traumatizing concept, who also don't want to talk about it because for those reasons. And I think kind of allowing space for people to bring all the parts of who they are, whether it is religion, culture, ancestry, like whatever feels really important to them, because it's not as if those things don't matter when we go into the healthcare system. It's just that we just don't have a space to talk about them. And so I think that's what we try to acknowledge, that everyone may have a different relationship and that we're not asking people to share what they don't want to share, but to know that all of the parts of themselves are welcome.
Yeah. And as we tried to build like an interdisciplinary space amongst the medical hierarchy and trying to flatten that, we found that it's equally disruptive to speak about our religious identities, to speak that we have a spiritual path or thoughts or feelings about spirituality because of the specific subculture that is healthcare, where it's like, no, we do not talk about that. We cope just fine with everything that's going on. Got this under control. I don't need whatever to help me get through that. So honestly, I think it's been a journey for both of us too, as we do this work, is building our own comfort. We're talking about our religious identity, our spiritual identity, the fact that I pray, the fact that I go to church. Like, I would never admit that at work, but kind of growing my own comfort with that part of my identity and like how it's powerful for me to lean on that in my work, because it's what brought me to my work initially. And Vivek Murthy talks about that, I think, in his podcast interview on Being, I can't remember where, but he's like, we see how our patients use their spirituality to build resilience and we applaud them, but for ourselves, we say never. So he says it in different terms, but why don't we allow ourselves that tool?
I feel like there's so many themes here. I feel like one that resonates with me early on is just female friendship. And, you know, I think I felt very lucky when I went through fellowships. I lived with two women, one of them being Charmaine, and hearing you guys talk about accountability partners, I think that was really built in. And it's funny because I hadn't really thought about that concept in this way, because, you know, we think about accountability partners and our diet or exercise or these types of things, but these things that are so important to us, we actually let them be lower priorities sometimes in our daily life. So I'm just really interested in how you guys decided that. I mean, maybe it was just like a natural progression, but it sounds like at some point you guys are like, this is important. We're going to hold ourselves accountable, and in the ways that you guys did that for each other.
I mean, I wish I could say like, oh, I was super proactive about it the whole time, had a very healthy residency, but it was actually always the opposite of what happened, is like when you're at your breaking point. And I think when in residency, I felt every day that I was in a place where I was misaligned with my values. And there were so many moments where I was like, I don't know if I'm going to graduate. Like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to finish this, because I disagree so strongly all the time with everything that's happening. And so I think when it got to that point, even though like I did have my Buddhist practice and that's what kind of helped me get to the end, when I was like at that decision tree of like, am I going to practice medicine at all? Or is it time to walk away? I think that's when I was like, I have to find a different way to live. Like if I want to do this, and it's been many years, I'm about to start my fifth year being attending this July. And I'm very grateful for the job I have right now, which is an amazing job. And I can't believe I found it. But I think it was just like after having so many years of really struggling and feeling like so much dread and anxiety before clinical shifts and feeling so isolated and having so much anxiety about whether I was like providing the right clinical care or did I make the right decision and like ruminating, especially my first couple years of being an attending, that I think that's kind of how Introspective Spaces was born, is that I was like, I just needed a place to talk about that, to know I wasn't the only one. And for me to like reconnect with what brought me into healthcare in the first place, and that my value of justice comes from also my own experiences of growing up in Arkansas and like living in all these parts of the country, and also comes from my spiritual tradition, and ignoring that basically felt like I was kind of not honoring what brought me there and like the kind of the person I wanted to be when I served patients. And so I think just having hit that near breaking point and almost leaving medicine, I think is what I was like, I have no other choice but to prioritize this if I want to even think about staying.
Yeah, I had this moment when I was a new nurse that I walked into an AutoZone to get a new part, like windshield wipers for my car. And the guy was getting me my windshield wipers, and in my head, I'm like, wow, this is a dream job. He just gets to sell auto parts. Maybe I could do that. And that was my aha moment of like, wow, something's really wrong. This is your new dream too. So I think Anu and I both felt that desire to escape and not do this anymore. And so fresh into the journey, it's like, how do you do all this training just to walk away a couple years later? So I'm going back to, how did I get here? Oh yeah, it was an expression of my desire to help others or my faith or whatnot. So, and then I also got really, really like physically ill too, when I was a new nurse, and chronic pain and hormonal imbalance and digestive distress. And I did try all the things like diet and nutrition and medicine. And so I had to go deeper too.
And thank you so much both for sharing. I wonder if there's any like specific example of like that misalignment in values that comes to mind when we've been there, right? Like also in our shifts and being like, oh my gosh, can I do this anymore? And those like moral distresses that we all feel. I wonder if there's any examples that you felt comfortable sharing with us.
Oh man, so many, so many. But I mean, I think even being able to talk about moral distress and giving it that name is huge. I feel like I didn't really have that vocabulary in residency. In training, there was just so many times where I disagreed with some of the clinical decision making that was happening. And there would be times where I would witness like clinicians like not wanting to use interpreters for non-English speaking families, or kind of fumbling by in broken Spanish and doing like surgical consents and things. And I would like call the interpreter and be like, nope, that's actually not legal to do that. And having to like jump in or advocate for attendings to go back into the room to speak with family. Or when I would witness like judgmental language people would use, especially about families of color in the hospital. And then you would see the differential attention kind of given to families that like knew how to navigate the healthcare system. It was one of the reasons when I graduated, I was like, I can only work in a county hospital. Like I just can't necessarily be a part of a system where it's so clear that there's multi-tiered levels of care based on language and wealth, even though that obviously does happen in every healthcare system. But I think that was such a source of moral distress that I also felt like I couldn't do anything about because I wasn't in the position to make the final decisions about patient care.
For me, I was an oncology nurse. And so I think it was pretty simple, just every day prolonging people's lives who didn't want to be prolonged, or their family didn't want or wanted them to prolong them. And I became a nurse to reduce people's pain, and I felt like I was increasing it. So that, you know, due to a fear of talking about, again, spirituality or what death or, you know, profits over people, that kind of led to this dynamic in my floor, or I guess in oncology in general. So that was my main moral distress. And like Anu said, I didn't learn that term until like after a while. I know students now have a much more familiarity with it, but didn't have a language for that and thought we were alone and that nobody else felt that. And that was kind of the lie of it all. It's like, no, actually everyone's feeling this. So I am glad we do have that language. And as we do share our stories, I acknowledge that they're ultimately universal. Like we all show up to this every day and it's just a slightly different rendition of every woman in healthcare.
Yeah, I similarly didn't know about the term moral distress until pretty late in residency, during actually a well-being elective that I did. It just really shifts my perspective on what was happening, because I think luckily a lot of people have moved away from this, but I think especially like early in training and intern year, second year is very much the, if you're burnt out, go to a yoga class or take a day off, which that's not the problem, right? And I remember during this time, I discovered an article where they did a study on residents at the center, and it was talking about burnout in terms of circumstantial burnout. So because of the situation and this bigger like existential burnout that we were all feeling. And so I think, yeah, I think it's this realization that it sounds like a lot of us have in tandem, and I'm glad that we're changing the dialogue about it and making it a priority. And so I'd love to hear more. So it sounds like you guys had this experience or these experiences, and then as you guys were talking, it sounds like there was a lot of interest, because your first virtual conference, there were 30 people who came, which is huge.
Yeah, it's been definitely like an amazing slow growth experience. Like we had an amazing turnout for our first retreat. And over the last 3 years, I've kind of been slowly building like an intentional community of healthcare workers. And I think it is definitely one of the things that we're constantly iterating to figure out, like, how do we best serve healthcare workers who are limited in time and resources and attention and are navigating limited bandwidth between their professional and personal lives. And so we've done a lot of different things over the last 3 years, like workshops. We started doing in-person retreats and have done the last two in LA, which have been really wonderful, and have been doing a lot of collaborations with other nonprofits that are led by healthcare workers. And I think that's, to me, one of the most amazing things that's really happened over the last few years is recognizing there's a lot of us who are out there who are saying, this is wild, like that healthcare is like this, that healthcare workers are leaving, that they're burnt out because of systemic constraints that no one is really talking about. And can we be part of like reimagining healthcare? And like, how do we do that? How do we support all of our individual communities? And so I think that has been an incredible thing to witness and to be inspired by. And it's definitely the thing that I take with me when I go into my clinical shifts and I'm just frustrated by the system, or I'm sad because I'm witnessing like so much systemic racism or things that are happening with individual patients. It gives me a lot of hope to know that there's so many people out there who also really care so deeply about patients, went into healthcare with that great intention, and are working towards building these community spaces in healthcare.
I read a book early on in our journey. I just found it. It's called Moral Injury Reconciliation by Dr. Lewis Jeffrey Lee. And it says, a practitioner's guide for treating moral injury, military personnel. So we learned a lot about from the veteran community. I guess they researched this first before we kind of adopted it into healthcare. And his thesis is that moral injury is a spiritual injury. And so I think that kind of was the foundation of how we built introspective spaces in our work is, okay, if it's a spiritual injury, then it probably needs a spiritual intervention. And like you kind of mentioned earlier, Kaylin, it's not as simple as attending a yoga class. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a spiritual intervention, but we're inspired by people like Richard Rohr of the Center of Action and Contemplation and many other activists, that it's both and, that it's both the spiritual practice and the systemic change. And so when we couldn't move forward because we're like, well, we need to change the system, so we can't do anything. And we were disempowered. We didn't know like how to take that first step. But through our conversations and through our reading, allowing ourselves to be like, what if this work of caring for each other emotionally, spiritually, reconnect with their values, what if that is directly interconnected with reimagining a new healthcare system that is just and serves all? So it was really hard to get past that, like, is this enough? I'm just focusing on myself. This is bad. How do I have a big impact? Like, we're all such dreamers and idealists. And so it took our convincing of ourselves to realize that starting small can actually have a big impact. And we look a lot to an activist, Adrienne Marie Brown, who wrote Emergent Strategy, and her thesis, she has many principles, but one of them is small is all. So if we can do things on the small scale, if we can care for each other on the small scale, that will eventually become reflected on the large scale. So if we can practice our community rooted in contemplative practice, witnessing each other, bringing humanity back to the center of our practice, sure, we might only be a drop in the bucket, but creating that muscle to believe that that can actually become the pattern for a new world, a new order of healthcare. So Introspective Space is just a small slice of the work that we want to see in healthcare, but that's what we founded it on.
Yeah, my dream would be for Adrienne Marie Brown's book to be like required reading for all medical students, because I think like that was a book we read early on. It's one of the foundational books for us, and I think it helped us really feel validated that there's like the deep connection between inner work and activism and advocacy. And I think that is something that many people have said over generations, like nothing that we talk about is anything that we invented. But I think we were really, like, we've read from so many different activists, like how important it is to create that space for rest, for joy, for play, for creativity, for connection, for community, and that we can't really sustain ourselves unless we have those things. And I think building community is the core of our work. We've been really lucky to find other people to collaborate with who believe in this, like Impact in Healthcare and Don't Clock Out and other healthcare-led organizations. And I think that, to me, feels like how we revolutionize healthcare is by offering people space to slow down and to be with themselves, to be with each other, and to like actually feel the things that make us mad, that cause us grief, that bring us joy, and kind of acknowledging that our systems don't allow us time to feel anything, and that it's enraging that we could have a patient die on rounds and then you still have to keep rounding. And I'm like, that's so crazy that that's like the healthcare system that we've allowed to be built. And so like, how do we step away and try to reimagine what that can look like? And I think where we begin is with ourselves.
Yeah, Adrienne Marie Brown says that basically we're living in somebody's dream. So in healthcare, we're living in the boardroom's dream. Like, they imagine this. So why can't we imagine and live into that dream instead?
As you all were talking, I was like reflecting on the phrase, like, be the change you want to see in the world. And that's essentially what you all are doing, trying to reimagine what it could be like. And I absolutely love that. And yeah, I haven't thought about medical training, and I'm sure nursing similarly, Laura, is that what I found really lacking in residency was the space to reflect on your feelings, on the patients you've taken care of, on your learning, and how I think we shortchange our learners when we don't offer them spaces to reflect, because that's the best learning, you know. We often, like on CP Solvers, we nerd out about diagnostic reasoning. And so much of that learning is having the time to think about, okay, what did I see? What did I learn? How is that different? How is it similar? And that is also applicable to how we feel emotionally and spiritually as well.
I agree, Charmin. It's not woven into our education or practice. I used to teach clinical nursing, like med-surg instructor, and one week is like spirituality week, and I asked them to do a spiritual assessment, and they all get so scared. They're like, okay, I asked them if they're Muslim, and I'm like, that's not a spiritual assessment. It's just, how are you coping? It's as simple as that, you know? But we just don't have that skill or tool. I mean, some people do, but they get it from other places in their life, not through their healthcare education.
In your expertise, like, where do you think that disconnect is from? Like, how did we just get so far away from our own humanity almost?
I mean, I think it's because we have a for-profit healthcare system. Like, I think the healthcare system is doing what it's designed to do, which is just generate profit and to be in a system really focused on metrics and numbers. And so a lot of the things that we talk about like aren't naturally revenue generating in a really direct way. And so it can be really tough to think about like how do we justify time for an entire team to gather after a patient has died and to honor their death and to compensate people for that time, that that's actually an expected part of our clinical practice, is to be able to step away and like go to retreats and to engage in creative practice. And to me, it feels like such a short-sighted view of healthcare, A, because people are literally leaving. So I think ultimately we won't have the workforce that we want, but also like how we show up, like our literal presence actually directly impacts patient care. And so the days that we show up and that we're so frazzled, we don't have time to even to drink water or to like eat food, how can we be showing up the way that we want to for patients? And it's, I don't blame any individual clinician when that happens because I know it's systemic, but I also feel like we all suffer when that happens. And so I think there that disconnect comes from the design, and our medical education reflects that design. And that's why the proportion of time we spend studying the Krebs cycle is like 10 times the amount of time we spend like really thinking about like what is our communication and our presence. And that's some of the things I talk about with trainees right now in my role, is I tell them like it matters how you show up. It matters where you position yourself in the room. If you actually hear what the patient is saying, all those things, people will never forget what that encounter is, even though this family might be the 10th family you see that day. Again, it's so hard when we're so tired and exhausted and haven't been given time to rest to be able to implement that. But it's also hard to witness patients not getting the care that they deserve.
I totally agree.
I think there's just so much to talk about. I'm wondering, as you're leading these workshops and having these events, what themes have you noticed? And are there ways that you have found helpful that we can incorporate into our practice, or ways to counteract some of these systemic issues that are so prevalent?
I think just like the theme of isolation is probably the biggest thing that comes. And I think that's the biggest thing that draws people to our events or any of the other groups that are supporting healthcare workers. And I think people just want to know that they're not the only ones feeling the way that they are, because they may be individuals in their own departments, and they're like, everyone else seems totally fine and I'm really suffering. There must be something wrong with me. And I think when people are in community spaces, that's when they recognize like, oh my gosh, like other people feel this. Like the things that I'm feeling are normal and even appropriate because of the system that we're in. And I think for us, we hope what people take away from the events that they come to is knowing that they're allowed to take space and that they have permission to rest. They have permission to have joy and gratitude. Like we can build our capacity to hold multiple things. And I think that's the thing I wish that we talked more about in healthcare, is holding paradox, that you can hold sometimes two contradictory things at the exact same time, and that you don't have to pick and choose just one thing. Like you can set boundaries and also be deeply compassionate, that you can have immense grief and also feel immense joy. Like those things are not always in contradiction to each other. And I think encouraging people to find time to build reflective space, ideally in community, but even just for themselves, and to do it in whatever way is meaningful, whether it's writing, whether it's walking, whether it's a meditative practice, like to find something that deeply resonates, and like allowing themselves even small moments to bring that in, just to basically create moments of pause, I think is like a place that anyone can start, and that hopefully in doing so, they find community as well. And knowing that there are other people who are trying to do the same, trying to show up in the best way that they can for patients. And I mean, there's so many specific stories that people have shared with us over the retreats and the workshops and things that we've done that have really echoed this idea of moral distress and how much that is really impacting healthcare workers.
Yeah, I think any successful spiritual practice widens our ability to hold the gray together. That's what, for me, I define as success. And in terms of bringing that into your workplace and into your clinical work, I remember when I was an oncology nurse, an inpatient, I never actually came back to myself from like when I woke up to when I went to bed. I was like, was I even there? Like, I guess, but I don't remember it, even though I literally just did like a 12-hour shift. So in that kind of crisis mode, first step is taking back small parts of your day. So really tiny intervention is like, okay, instead of scrolling Instagram on my phone and I'm drinking my water and eating my protein bar for lunch, what if I just did nothing for 5 minutes? So just small radical acts. We started a couple years ago doing a 21-day contemplative challenge for the clinical setting. So mind practices, body practices, and spirit practices that could be incorporated into our day. And it was online, so we had like an accountability group. But that was one practical way that we were trying to bring that into our work. And like Anu said, our barriers are huge. Time is our huge barrier. So we are still noodling on what is the best way to carve out that time for women in healthcare, for ourselves, and to be together. I think it's also tied into our idea of enoughness. Like, we are all very driven, ambitious women. And what is enough? And how do we define enough? And because once we define enough, then we can take a break and give us ourselves what we need.
I love that. I was wondering, okay, I have a few questions, but I guess first, I realized we haven't really defined moral distress and moral injury for the audience. So I was hoping if you guys don't mind just telling us how you think about that or even your definitions of that for the bigger audience.
Yeah, happy to. We actually just did a moral distress webinar in collaboration with Don't Clock Out, which is a national peer support group for healthcare workers. And moral distress actually originated from the nursing literature and originally was defined as like having like moral certainty about the correct course of action, and then some sort of systemic barrier making it not possible for you to enact that. And like since then, the definition has expanded where you don't necessarily have to have moral certainty. It can still be an uncertain situation, but the key is like having like a systemic constraint that's impacting you. So it's a little bit different than like a distressing situation that you just might be witnessing. It kind of allows us to contextualize ourselves within a broader system. And moral injury actually comes from the military literature. And that one actually is the psychological, behavioral, social, like spiritual impact that can happen from perpetrating or witnessing something that is in direct disalignment with your values. And so both of those kind of encompass similar ideas, but getting into this idea of moral residue, that like the more times you experience moral distress, every subsequent experience will hit you harder. And so that's why they call it like a crescendo effect, that every single time you witness something or engage in something that's against your values, the symptoms that you feel of moral distress, of physical, emotional, psychological, will be even greater every time.
Thank you so much, Anu, for defining that. Yeah, I totally agree. I feel like these are such important terms that I wish I had earlier on. Going back to one of your earlier points about moral distress and the relationship with like ethical dissonance and this idea that we're not able to act congruently with our values, or that sometimes the institution says they have a certain value like mind, body, spirit, but then the behaviors or the practice is actually different than that. So I remember, for example, in residency, you know, we'd work somewhere that's like, we really value equitable care, or we really value helping the underserved. But then day in and day out as an intern, I'm just discharging people to the streets and they're just coming right back. And so there's just something very distressing about that. And it's not that they don't care about that, but it's like the behavior and what is advertised and put forth is very different. And I think that's when I really started to think about this burnout, this moral distress. It's not so much I'm not getting enough days off, but just you come back to the same system that is really constraining.
Absolutely. And that kind of goes back to I think the right word is anger that people feel. And we are offered, okay, a training on make sure you take a breath before you go into the patient room to reduce your anxiety and be more present or something like that. Our response is pure anger, because the way to actually address moral distress for nurses in the hospital is to increase staffing levels. And so that's what we're asking for, is increase staffing. Don't give us these band-aids, even though it's a spiritual intervention and we're spiritual people and we want that anger that we have been consumed by because of that violation of saying that you are for us and then actively understaffing us so that you can have a few more zeros next to your paycheck.
And Kaylin, I think what like you're describing is kind of naming like the cognitive dissonance that I think people feel when people are, they're secularizing practices that have like deep cultural and spiritual roots and trying to use them to increase people's productivity. And so examples are like mindfulness apps, which are great. Like, I feel like they can be really useful tools, but when your institution gives you a mindfulness app, but they don't pay for Spanish interpreters on the weekend, you're like, part of you kind of recognizes there's a disconnect here. Like, you're telling me to be peaceful and mindful, but you're not doing the things that would help me feel like I'm actually providing the care I want to. So that makes me really angry, because mindfulness comes from a very historical lineage of Buddhism, and of which like right action and right livelihood are core ethics alongside of it. So when people take it out of the ethics in which it's situated amongst, you can feel that like it's only going to take you so far, or only make you feel so good, because a part of you knows this doesn't really make sense. Like, that you're giving me this yoga class. Yoga actually has a very deep spiritual background of justice. And so if you do that, but you're not giving residents more than one day off in a 12-day stretch, this doesn't feel like the right intervention. Even though it's not to say those things aren't useful, they definitely can be. But I think it's also important just to name what people are really looking for at the systemic level are larger interventions that actually allow us to provide the kind of care we want. And I think if people even just named that while they were giving us like these individually focused practices, that in itself at least would be a little bit better, just to say like, hey, like, we know this isn't everything. This is what we can hope we can do. But I think so much of that work is focused on just like individuals being more productive, instead of thinking about like, how do we improve the collective well-being of the healthcare workers in this institution?
Right. I agree with Laura. It feels like angry is the right word, or anger is the right word, because it almost feels worse in a way. It almost feels like a slap in the face. Like, if you're going to make us work really hard and squeeze every ounce of productivity, at least own it, rather than being like, look at all the ways we're supporting you.
And honestly felt just very confusing to me, because I'm like, I came here, I joined this Catholic hospital because I believe in nurturing people, mind, body, and spirit. And just that incongruence, it just made me feel very confused, which then made me not take any action, which then paralyzed me, which then led to that spiral of inaction and powerlessness and isolation.
I'm curious now, you know, you both mentioned feeling like fighting in the face of moral distress, and how at one point it was much more debilitating than you find to be now that you have adapted these more reflective processes and found this community. How has your like schema in approaching these kind of situations changed as a result of that? Do you find that now when you're faced with these same problems, because unfortunately we know that a lot of times, I'm sure that you're still facing many of the conflicts that kind of brought you to this place in the first place?
Yeah. I mean, I think for myself, like it has influenced like where I work. And so I think that was something that was, I made a lot of intentional choices after trying a lot of things my first couple of years of like, where I'm at work, how much clinical practice I feel like I could actually do and feel like I can show up the way that I want to. And also for me, like having the Introspective Spaces community and that platform, I think helps me feel like I have a place to come back to. Like when I do witness those same things that have always been happening in healthcare, I know that there's a place I can come and say like, I'm very sad that this patient died, or this patient is being taken away from their family due to DCFS holds, or the different things that like I witness like in my work. And I also think like now I believe and incorporate reflective practice as just a part of my life. And so it's obviously been a lot harder since I had a baby to like build in, but I think it definitely is something that I feel like I have a much greater awareness of like how stress feels in my body. And so I think I can just get clued in a lot sooner. And so I think building that awareness of like, okay, like I don't think I'm like doing that well. And historically I would have just been like, that's okay, I just keep pushing. Like no problem. I can just keep doing writing one more thing, or just like sending another email, or logging back in overnight. And I think kind of setting those boundaries for myself of saying like, the minute I notice it, I just am like, okay, I have to stop. I have to do the things that I feel like I know can really replenish myself, which are, for me, reading is a huge, huge source of well-being, spending time outside, being in company of other people, of good friends. And so I think I just feel like having gone through the cycle so many times, I can identify it happening sooner. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I now believe much more deeply in how critical those things are, that I know like it's not negotiable for me anymore. Like I'm like, if I want to practice in seeing patients, then I have to do those things. And if my life changes and I can't do those things, then I have to leave medicine. Because I think for me, like practicing medicine I don't believe in, that was the thing that was going to kill me. Like, I was like, that I cannot do.
Well said, Anu. I agree. For me, ultimately, changing environment was a big thing. And then again, coming back to dealing with like enoughness and my own ego of, you know, working less or working in a less acute setting, things that healthcare culture doesn't value or devalues, creating your own sense of what is valuable to you and discerning that from other voices, from the culture that you're in, I think is a journey. We love accompanying people who are on that journey too. A lot of people come to introspective spaces when they're like rethinking their place in healthcare. Sometimes just being open and honest with what you actually want instead of what you think you're supposed to do.
Thank you for sharing. I think that's so well said. It sounds like being radically generous with yourself and radically compassionate. And I think we all think about, we only have so much energy and compassion and all these things, and we often spend it on patients or other people. And then at least I feel like I did in my experience, right? And then sometimes you feel like there's not necessarily that much for yourself, but just extending that same generosity that you extend to others, to yourself, and being honest and knowing that you're deserving of rest and joy is really important. And so I'm really glad that we're having this conversation. I also wanted to ask you guys, you know, for us in women diagnosis, we thought it was really important to carve out a space for women's voices. I'm curious for you, as you were dreaming up your organization, what your thoughts were in that realm.
I think when we started introspective spaces, like kind of creating the space for women in healthcare felt really important, because that was the identity that was something that was really important for us and that we felt like we could most authentically lead from. The retreats and all those spaces have been really so precious to be able to have those carved out. And over the last like 4 years, I think we've grown and expanded. And so not all of our spaces anymore are just for women in healthcare. But I think we're so grateful for the ones that we do have, like especially our retreats. There are so many things that people don't often get to say in their clinical jobs that it can feel really safe and protective and to be able to be in that container and to actually share what it means to be like a woman in healthcare and to talk about like all the different identities and challenges and barriers that sometimes we may be afraid to voice. Especially if we're in specialties or places where some of the things that are important parts of our identity may not be valued or centered. And so I think it's definitely been an evolution for us of trying to figure out how best we can support women and also recognizing all healthcare workers need help. And so we're in that transition phase now of being able to honor kind of similarly the both and, that we have spaces for women and we have spaces for all healthcare workers, and also knowing that it's important to have spaces for folks who are non-binary or who don't identify on the traditional gender spectrum and who often don't have a space in a lot of healthcare, like really organizations.
We've been really inspired by Priya Parker, who wrote The Art of Gathering. And we learned from her work how generous it is to be specific, and that the more specific that we are in our work, the more powerful it can be. It can feel exclusionary to say this is just for women, but if you look at it on the other side, like Anu said, it makes a more specific and powerful, safer space for all of us to share our experiences.
One question that I had, you know, as you all mentioned, this is, change is slow, progress is slow. And I love all of that you all reflected on about like how each other and ourselves while we're doing the hard work. And I was curious to know, like, what are you guys looking forward to next?
Well, we're always iterating constantly. We're probably the worst business people out there, because I think you're supposed to stick to one product and make it really good. We're like, let's try this. That sounds fun. Let's do that. But so I think what I'm personally excited about right now is I've been really impacted by the book, The Artist's Way, a book written in the 80s by Julia Cameron, who's a playwright. And it's a workbook, essentially 12 weeks of reconnecting with your inner artist. She believes that everybody is an artist. Everybody's artistic. Everybody is creative. So it's kind of like a 12-week journey, mostly like tasks that she has you try to reconnect with the playful inner child part of yourself. And so I've done it a couple of times. It's been very energizing, healing, and we've used some of the practices in our retreats, which has led to lots of laughter and expression and connection. And so we are excited to do that as a wider cohort of introspective spaces. In the fall, we're hoping to create a bunch of pods of groups that are reading this book together, doing activities together, and having an accountability group to check in with every week about that journey. Still iterating what exactly how this looks like. Maybe it's with your floor at your hospital. Maybe there's groups that are online. Maybe there's groups that are by affinity group, you know, just for physical therapists. So we're kind of iterating that back end piece of it. But ultimately, that is one thing I'm personally really excited about. And then culminating in an in-person retreat in LA in the fall.
We're just excited. We normally like slow down in the summer and really don't do that many events. We're going to do like a virtual art space in July just for people to do their own DIY art practice for fun. But I think we're both really excited just to like read and write and to like deepen our connections with like people who are interested in supporting our work and like friends who are running similar organizations. And I think like having those periods of slowing down and being able to do some of the big picture thinking are things that I'm really excited about.
That sounds amazing. And I can totally relate to what you were saying, Laura, about these spaces just allows you creativity and innovation. And that's what we love about like digital media, for example, is that like we can like create and innovate and change. And you know, especially I feel like when your other part is in this hierarchical system that the change is slow, like having these spaces to be able to play around with, it becomes complementary. And the other thing that I was like reflecting is, as you mentioned, just like power of finding your community and finding that part of you that is quirky and different and finding people who enjoy the same things, like whether it's something like nerdy, like we do in diagnostic reasoning, whether it's like something spiritual aside. And that is, I think, like one of the big things that I always try to talk to residents as they're coming up is that invest in those spaces, and that is what gives you sustenance a lot of the time, is whatever that is, if it's like going on hikes or like finding the people who you like to do and you can talk medicine with as well and talk about like your experiences. It's so important and very rewarding. And honestly, I always say like my antidote to burnout is kind of like my professional development, my personal development. And that looks different for a lot of people. And it should be, because we're all different and we have like different interests and love in medicine and outside medicine. And there's a space for both. Like we can hold both things at the same time.
I love that.
I'm so glad that there are people like you doing things like this. And I just am really reflecting on how important community is and how we've become such an individualistic society. And I think it's this idea, right? Like, I feel like for me, it's very hard for me to sometimes feel compassionate for myself, but it's very easy for me to do it for a friend. And the reverse is true. And so I think sometimes, you know, we don't have to do it all alone. So I think that's really important too. Like, we don't have to be everything. And also just recognizing that we're deserving of all this time and to carve out this space for ourselves.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm not sure about medicine, but I know our origins in nursing, a lot of it was in spiritual communities of women living together, reflecting together after their work, having spaces to eat together, to, you know, in the midst of the work. So I do think that's kind of how our caring was set up to be as we care for others.
And Kaylin, I just love the term like radical generosity that you brought in, because I think having compassion for ourselves is the hardest work, right? Because I think it involves like slowing down enough to acknowledge what we feel. And also I think to remind ourselves that we are worthy of everything that we offer to other people, because in some way it feels so disruptive because we often don't carve out that time, nor is there any incentive to do so. That's time that we're taking that's really countercultural. And I think in our last retreat, one of the moments I think that was so moving is we did a metta meditation, which is like a loving kindness meditation in Buddhism and something that's very important to me. And that meditation starts out by saying that you offer first to yourself, like peace, happiness, ease, and health before you offer that to anybody else. And so we all went in a circle and offered that to each other. And I think that was one of the moments that people were like, oh, like, when is the last time I offered this to myself? And that someone has looked me in the eye and with most genuine intention offered this to me. If we can even just take space just to remind ourselves that we're worthy of everything that we offer to someone else, that we fight for, that we're angry for, all those things, like, we deserve just as much. I think that alone is pretty radical in healthcare.
Yeah, we say a lot to each other, everything we're doing is not created by us. It's nothing new. It's all just ancient, you know, truths and wisdom that we're bringing to, well, bringing back perhaps to healthcare and to each other. So back to basics of just how to carve out our own worthiness. And it's no easy task. Here I am, co-founder of Introspective Spaces. Still, I can't fully feel that worthiness. I still, you know, put myself or others before myself. And so it's never somewhere you fully arrive, but together we can do it a little better.
It's just funny how we are always learning the same lessons and relearning them. But I agree. It's simple, right? It's straightforward, but it's not easy to do. Yeah.
And I think that's why we need each other, right? Because I feel like there's so many things that are simple, but not easy. And I think just to have people who like look at you and are just like, who can see how brilliant and amazing and kind and compassionate you are and reflect that back, mm-hmm. I think is like, that's how we bring all of us along too, like, as we're trying to like reimagine something more beautiful in healthcare.
And I used to see it as such a weakness of myself that I'm like, why can't I do this? Like, I'm so frustrated with myself. Why can't I keep this practice or take care of myself, and just all this like self-shame. And finally, I don't know how, but I just accepted. I'm like, I am so much better when I do this with other people. And it's not a defect. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with me and that other people are better because they look like they can do it by themselves. Maybe they can, but just accepting that it's not defective to need that.
Well, I know that there are a lot of people at this stage transitioning to the next step, to whether that's fellows going on or residents going on to their first attending job. Or I know Jane is graduating and starting intern years. So I think transitions can be a point of a lot of distress and anxiety for people. So I'm wondering if there's any advice you have, or even if there's one thing you could tell people to do in this transition phase, or advice you would give them, what that would be.
I think, I don't know, Laura, if you remember, but our second retreat was actually, the theme was transition. And so we designed an entire retreat on that. Because I think we were both going through major transitions. I was starting my, like, it wasn't maybe first year attending. And I remember we read this book, Transitions, kind of talked about how transition is such a normal part of life. And that we, like, historically, people used to view life in a more circular format. And I think maybe in the 1800s, like, people started to think of life as chronologic. That you have, like, certain milestones and you get them, and if you miss one or you're not at the societal standard, like, you're behind. And I think this book helped reframe, like, oh, like, transition is normal. And we actually do not make space for all the multifaceted emotions that come up. And one of the things that they offered in this book was to create space for grief, that with every transition, even as joyful as some of them can be, like, there's a part of you that is changing, that something that you're letting go of, an identity that's shifting, relationships that are changing, maybe even a physical location. I think one of the exercises they did that we did in the retreat was like creating a grief garden. I just like drew in a piece of paper, like little flowers for all the things in my life that I wanted to honor that were no longer going to be true. And that space then kind of allows you the opportunity to celebrate what is coming up and the things that are new and exciting. But I think unless you allow space for both those things, it can, I feel like, really compound how challenging a transition can be.
Beautifully said, Anu. Another thought is from Celtic spirituality, who believed that doorways are sacred space. Anytime you walk through a doorway is sacred. So similarly, as you're walking from one place to another, they think of it as a very like thin space where you're very close to like the spiritual realm. And so acknowledging it as a sacred time where you can hear things more clearly, truths about yourself or about the world. So just making, like Anu said, making space to listen.
And I think having building community too, that to me feels like a part that we like have talked a lot about it, but I think we often forget like building community and like maintaining friendships and relationships is like a muscle like anything else. It's not something that people are just like born with and all of a sudden they're like, oh my gosh, like I have tons of friends that I had put no effort into maintaining and I've had forever. Like it's kind of reminding ourselves that like that is something that is worthy of like our time and attention and intentionality. And obviously we don't always have the same time that we would like in every phase of our life. But thinking through like, what do I need for my own well-being? Like, what are the relationships and the community that I really want to foster? And allowing ourselves to like prioritize that in the same way we prioritize like studying for step three, saying that like these things hold equal weight and are equally necessary for my sustainability.
Yeah, I really like that. I feel like what I am really hearing is really giving yourself permission to be honest with yourself, to be honest about your needs and wants, to allow your space time, and then to feel all the emotions, right? And to feel however you feel, because I think there's also that, right? Sometimes you're like, this is such a happy thing. Like, I should feel so excited, but instead I feel dread or whatever it is. And then feeling bad that you feel that way. So just, I feel like a lot of the theme here is just being compassionate with yourself and permission to feel and take space.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you for modeling your female friendship and the space that you've created here.
It's the best. This is the best collab. I feel like this is great.
I know. Friendships are just the best, you know. I'm sorry, everybody else. Slightly biased, maybe, but
I know. Well,
I know. I think that's what Laura and I talk about, like how radical friendship is in like being a tool for like revolution, and how like even for us with introspective spaces, like creating interdisciplinary friendships, I think for me has been such like a transformative thing, because like then I just like know what more, so much more about what people are going through at work. And so I think it's just given me so much more understanding and empathy for like my colleagues. And I'm just like, I feel like as many places we can to have authentic relationship across healthcare specialties or departments or divisions, like even Kayla and I being in medicine and peds like at the same hospital. And then like getting to come to like the American Medical Women's Association talk, even just like having that amount of cross connection, I think is also really radical.
For sure. I feel like friendship and community feels undervalued these days, but that's how people lived so long ago in communities. Like no one expected you to do it alone.
That's why I just call you for all my EKGs. That's right. I feel like one thing you mentioned that really resonated is like taking a job place that is like really in line with your values. And you know, I learned this when I was a kid. My mom, whenever we were like going to go to a new school, my mom would like go check out like the environment and scope out like who's going, what is it about. And I was like, why does she do that? And I'm like, oh yeah. It's the environment, is those relationship that really, really affects you. And it's not the clinical job for me, it's the people that I get to do the job with. And that's my antidote. It's like clinical medicine is so frustrating.
It is frustrating.
I don't have my friends and like those colleagues to complain to run things by. Like I wouldn't make it, you know?
So crazy. I mean, it's like we all, when we think about like the world that we're in, right? Like we're in this like capitalist, like very productivity oriented space. Mm-hmm. And so I think it does involve constant reminding of ourselves, like when we are caught up in that, that I'm like, oh yeah, like I'm valuing myself based on how much I could get done today, instead of like recognizing inherently I'm already worthy. What if like community was my core value and I designed my entire life mm-hmm. like around that value, which I now have. And I think it does make me feel like even though our piece is so tiny, at least I know that I feel like I'm doing the most I can do for however long I get to do it.
Do you have advice as an attending, like when you're on the wards or in the hospital, and you notice these things come up with your trainees when they're being hard on themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I think I try to model as much as I can. And yeah. I think one of the things I feel like for me feels really important, I try really hard not to skip, is setting like the introductions, because I feel like having that time to like get to know people, like what motivates them, like what they're hoping to get out of the rotation, and for me to share about myself. These are my expectations. Like, this is what I hope you get out of this rotation, and this is why. And I think like creating that container, even if I'm only on for like a day, every time I don't do it, I feel like it makes having those conversations or like acknowledging things like so much harder and like kind of out of context. And I think people don't know where to put that, because there's obviously such a power differential. But I think when I frame it in like my deepest intention is like, A, that you learn the clinical aspect of this work, but also I really care about equitable care. And like, this is what that looks like for me in the hospital, using an interpreter if you don't speak the language, like this is how I approach this issue. Or when like there's issues that come up for us, like in pediatrics, like a mom is HIV positive, and I'm just naming like, yeah, this is a really distressing situation to me. So trying to be like, this is like why I think it's important to document it that way, and just like naming as much of as I can. And like, who knows, right? Like, in the end, like what people take away, but creating that template, and I think naming moral distress, like when it comes up, for me has at least been helpful to say, like, at least in this specific rotation, this is a space where you can share those kinds of things.
Love it.
This has been so amazing. I can't wait to hear all about your events. I'm glad they're going to be in LA selfishly. I'm just so excited for all the work that you guys are doing and that you're doing. And I'm so glad that we were able to connect and learn more about this. I feel like there are so many things that we had questions about, and you're like, we did a webinar on that, or we did a workshop on that. And so it's amazing.
And yeah, I just want to thank you both for sharing your thoughts, sharing yourself, and for just the radical honesty and generosity that you all offered to us too. It's just so refreshing. I feel like the more we can just show up as our authentic self, the better we are all are. So I deeply, deeply appreciate that about both of you. And I'm such a big fan.
Thank you so much for having us. And Kaylin, I'm so happy the universe brought us back together. It's been such a blessing.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you for everything.
Likewise.
Keep it up.
Bye. That's a wrap, folks. Thank you all so much for tuning in.
If you like this episode and want more from the Clinical Problem Solvers, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter that includes episode recaps, teaching points, and educational graphics.
And if you'd like to join us live, check out our daily virtual morning reports, where we come together as a global community to discuss cases and learn together. For more information and instructions for signing up, check out the link in the episode description.
See you next time.